You are listening to episode 2 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, I'm your friendly host. This show is about Linux, Unix, BSD, OpenSolaris, or Illumos as it's called now. And in this episode I want to talk about, well, my report on Ohio Linux Fest, which I've just sort of returned from, and I say sort of because it's been a week now, but it feels like it's just returned from it. I want to talk about Open Indiana, which is the Illumos-based OpenSolaris successor, and I want to talk about Linux Audio Explained. Yes, I'm going to explain it all here for you forever. So let's get started. Linux Fest. Oh, wait, you thought I was going to forget, but I didn't. It is time for listener feedback first and foremost. There have been a couple of different feedbacks lately. One was about the broken link that was on, I think, episode 900 for all of the, or maybe that was 901, I don't know. There was a broken link to some show notes about, I think, shift and parsing bash options. So that link has been fixed. I just had an extra L in the URL. Not the word URL, but the actual URL had an extra L in it. I removed that extra L and now it works. So if you were trying to get to the show notes on bash, you now can. Remy emailed me also about the bash thing, specifically about, well, a question about whether or not shift would allow lots of different orders of the options. I don't know exactly to what degree. To some degree, yes, it will, because I can issue things like, for instance, one of the programs that I'm using, the shift trick in, is Sport, my little Slackware port project that will crawl a tree of Slack builds and install what you want it to install. So it uses shift, and I can do sport dash c dash I dash dash build dash only vlock, and it will concatenate the information about vlock. It will install, and with the option of building only, the program vlock. So, I mean, you can do multiple, and I could do it in different orders, too. I could do dash I and then dash C. It doesn't matter. The one thing that I don't know for sure about, because I haven't really tried it, is where each option takes an argument unto itself. Now, as far as I know, from what I sort of understand, is yes, you can do it. So if for instance, I had, I don't know, sport dash C foo dash I bar, it should still work. I would have to change the shift amount from 1 to 2, however, because then I would always anticipate that an option is going to have an argument. So if I'm doing sport dash C foo, then I shift twice, and the new number 1 becomes the old number 0, 1, 2, 3, rather than shifting 1, where the new number 1 becomes the old number 2. So, as far as I know, yes, it will work, but you have to have some amount of predictability. I guess you could build in unpredictability by saying, if the argument to this option starts with a dash, then shift 1, you know, and that way you could always kind of know for sure whether you have an option or an argument. So, the answer I think is yes, however, I haven't really played around with it a whole lot myself to know for sure. I've done a lot of tests with shift, mostly in my effort to understand it. It took me a while to kind of get the idea through my head. So in my tests, I have done things like that. But again, it's not something I've actually implemented, but try it. One of the links that Raimi sent me is to a series on bash tips being done on his, I think it's a him, right? Raimi is a guy's name. His website. So you can go to https://raimii.org/s as in shell /tags/bash-bits.html. I will have that link in the show notes, and I will even copy and paste it so that I do not mistype it. Lots of bash tips there. I'm going to start reading it myself. It's really cool. Great to know about. Hip hip hooray. Raimi also says that he uses the what is it, git opts or ls ops or something like that. Some other option parser, parse ops maybe, I don't know, option parser for bash, and likes it a lot. So I looked at that one. I did. I just didn't understand it as well as I did shift, so I have not yet used that myself. Okay, next email is from Gariola, or Garjola, or whatever, and Gariola says, is there a way to make a UDEV rule run as a particular user? So the UDEV tutorial in, I guess, the zeroth episode of the season was talking about, you know, a UDEV rule, and it sort of by nature runs as a root, as with root permissions, yes, because it's something that's happening in real hardware when you plug it in. It's happening at the a very low level, kind of system level. So inherently, it's a root process. Gariola is asking, is there a way to make a UDEV rule per user, you know, by an individual user? Now, as far as I know, and I could be wrong, and if there are any POSIX experts out there that want to argue this or to inform me otherwise, that would be fantastic. But as far as I know, in order to make such a thing occur, you would have to do a SUID. You would have to switch the user ID to some other user, and from what I've understood, what I've read online and in the security mailing lists and stuff, is that that's not a great idea. It's a little bit dangerous. And I could be wrong. Maybe switching user ID to a non-root user ID is totally fine, totally secure. I don't know. But as far as I know, that's how you would have to do it. So UDEV is not yet, question mark, a per-user type deal the way that, say, crontab would be, or you know, cron is with a crontab per-user. I think that would be kind of cool now that Gariola mentions it, but as far as I know, that's not the way that it works right now. And if you look at the way that Unix deals with hardware, it usually does deal with hardware on the root level. For a very long time, very early on in my Slackware experimentations, you know, there was this thing, like, you had to be root unless you knew what group to add yourself to. You had to be root to do things like mounting volumes and manipulating your Wi-Fi connection and things like that. If you knew what groups to add yourself to as a user, then you were okay. But inherently, you were expected to be root if you were dealing with physical hardware interfaces on the machine. So I have an idea, have a notion that UDEV probably expects you to be root and to run as root, and that's that. Now, that said, I'm, you know, it's Unix. There's a way to make it not require root. I don't know the security implications. I do know that on many desktop environments like KDE and to some degree GNOME, although I think they've pared it down a lot on GNOME that I've seen, I could be wrong, there are interfaces there are the programs and interfaces that will allow you to set certain UDEV-like rules. I don't know if it's actually tapping into UDEV or if it's some other window manager interface abstraction layer. I don't know, but I mean, it could be what is it? I forget the name of the one for KDE that deals with hardware, or maybe I'm thinking of Phonon, which isn't really hardware; it's more sound. But anyway, I don't know how it does it, but you can go into like system settings or settings on GNOME, and tell it, okay, when I insert a drive, mount it automatically for me, or do not automatically mount it. You know, offer to open it in either the file manager or a picture viewer or a disk burning application, or you know, whatever. You've got certain choices. So to some degree, the user can kind of define different things that they want to have happen upon the insertion of a disk or a drive or whatever. That's not exactly the same thing, though. I don't think that there's the level of a user being able to define an action such as, okay, run this script. I don't know. And I again, as I said in the other episode, I don't even know how often I would really recommend that as an option. The only reason I do it for my thumb drive is because the thumb drive is my life on a stick, and I really want that thing to be backed up no matter what. And I'm doing that on my laptop, so I consider these two devices very much under my constant supervision. I would not have something like that happening on my work machine or something where it sees a lot of traffic and it could have unpredictable results, such as introducing a remove RF everything script or something like that suddenly because I chose to run to accept any thumb drive and to do some action and it had malicious code on it or something. I don't know. So the answer I think is yes and no. And then Per emailed me and he says when doing the UDEV investigation, like trying to figure out, okay, where's my thumb drive being plugged into, what kind of system is it on, etc., he gives me a command which is /f /var/logs/messages, which is basically the -f as in follow flag on the tail command says to follow this file. So give me the tail end of this file. I think the default is, 10 lines or something? But continuously. Don't give me back a prompt. Just give me the last 10 lines. So if it's a file to which the system or someone is continuously concatenating stuff to the end of, or appending information to the end of, then you get the new information sort of on screen as it appears. I used to use this a lot in at an old job that I had where I was doing a lot of QA testing, and what I would do is I would echo some very unique and noticeable string into the messages file myself. So like echo quote plus 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 quote greater than /var/log/messages or whatever. I'd have to do that with root, obviously, and you can actually echo strings into the messages file. I don't know if you're supposed to do this or not, but I did it anyway. And then I'd go back to the messages file and I'd look through it so that I could kind of see when important things were happening. So, and that was for a QA job. And I mean, these were disposable systems, so if I screwed something up, it didn't really matter. But I used to use it a lot. And then I kind of forgot about it. So it is a handy thing to remember, tail-f. So thank you very much for all of these emails, every one of you. And if I have forgotten anyone, I apologize, and I've probably emailed you back, although I have to admit over the summer when I was on the hiatus, I probably missed some emails. I know that just recently I finally got back to someone who had emailed me like 3 weeks ago or something, and usually it doesn't take me that long, but I was pretty busy, so that's why. It's nothing personal, and I do apologize. Okay, so now we can start with Ohio Linux Festival review. Ohio Linux Fest 2013. What a great event Ohio Linux in general is. I think it's the first Linux-only conference that I attended, and it is really, truly, it's just kind of like, you know, the original for me. It's a great, great place. And everyone running the thing is just, they're a bunch of fantastic people. And I attended this year. Last year, I literally forgot to attend. I was busy around that time of year, as I lately have been around this, like, September, October timeframe, simply because that's when the new semester starts, so there's a lot of work for me to do usually around that time. So I was really busy, and I just overlooked the weekend. I mean, I was not doing anything that weekend. It snuck up on me, and by the time I realized that the event was that weekend, I had already missed it. So really too bad. That was the first Ohio Linux conference that I missed since, I don't know, some other time that I started going. But anyway, I came back this year, and I was very, very happy to be back. And I have to say that my entire conference experience has really shifted. I've always been a fan of conferences and conventions and trade shows and things like that. I mean, I grew up going to Star Trek conventions and sci-fi conventions, so I was already kind of familiar with the, you know, it was a very comfortable territory for me to show up, sign up, get your badge or whatever, go into a big place, find out what you're going to go do for the day, kind of plan out your day. You know, it was all very familiar territory. And when I started getting more into the film world, they're not really called conferences there. They're usually called trade shows. And, you know, like the C, what is that one? I don't actually ever go to it, so I don't know it. But the big famous Consumer Electronic, oh, CES. CES, which I've never gone to because it's Consumer Electronics, but, you know, that style of show, like NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, SIGGRAPH, things like that. So I kind of I'm very familiar with that whole feel and that whole culture of the conference scene. So when I started going to Linux conferences, it felt very natural. I was not terribly nervous about it. It was something that I just kind of knew and was really, really comfortable with. And so I went there, and it was cool because I was hungry for Linux knowledge. And generally speaking, I could go into any talk and be satisfied, because even if it was over my head, I felt like via osmosis I was getting something. You know, I was hearing the terminology. I was hearing how these people spoke, how people used computers, and I was seeing them use Linux on screen. You know, it was all very interesting to me. And it was all very, just, I mean, like, everything was so above me that anything was satisfying. And recently, I have found myself being, I guess in a way, harder to please, because now I know what I need to know, or I think I know what I need to know, but on some level I know what I'm looking for. I go to conferences lately, and I'm saying lately like the past 2 years, I think. So this is quite recent, considering that there's only like, what, 3 or 4 or 5 conferences a year. So, you know, lately I've gone to conferences with actual agendas. I mean, maybe they're not written down or put into words, but I kind of, in the back of my mind, I know what interests me and why it is interesting to me. So I really am able to sit down with the program guide, which, by the way, this year at Ohio Linux Fest was one sheet of paper. It was really, really handy. I mean, I've always felt that the programming books, I mean, they're great, they're nice, but I mean, they are overkill, right? I mean, give me a piece of paper that says when people are talking and where to show up, and that's pretty much good enough. I mean, the bios of all the speakers are interesting, but I mean, if you just put that online, people can look at it if they're really curious. I don't think the page had the names of the speakers. That was a little bit troublesome. Like, I would have put the names of the speakers just so I would know, like, if there were any talks that I sort of need to go to out of obligation because I know that person and I should go support them personally. But anyway, you know, I sat down and looked at what the talks were and really intentionally went to certain talks because I knew that was information that I was either toying around with implementing at work, or because it was a technology that I was interested in for a personal project. And it really was. It's a different style now, because I really go looking for information rather than, okay, I'm going to go and just hit me with anything and I'll be happy. So it's a good thing. I'm not saying that this is a bad or disturbing thing. This is good. I feel like this is where I should be at a conference now. Like, this is kind of like, it means to me at least that I've grown a little bit. You know, I've gotten better at this whole Linux thing, and am now really starting to focus in on things that I need to know. So it's been really refreshing. I think if I had kept going to conferences kind of as a sponge, then it might have become tedious almost. I mean, it's just, you know, you can only go and just listen to words that you don't understand for so long until you finally kind of give up. So the fact that a lot of this is making so much sense to me now that I'm actually having to pick and choose so that I walk out of there with actual knowledge having been gained, that's a great thing. It's research, and it's good. So that was cool. There were a lot of great talks. I can't remember all of the good ones. One that keeps standing out in my mind was the IBM talk on the power architecture. Now, if you've listened to this show for any amount of time, you probably know that I'm a... Well, maybe. I don't know. I don't really talk about it so much on the show. But you may or may not know that I'm a fan of RISC processing. RISC processing is the reduced instruction set for a CPU. And I don't really... I couldn't tell you exactly what that means on a here I design CPU level. But I do know from experience... I mean, I had an old job where it was my assigned task to compare the video render times of RISC processors versus x86 processors. The employer wanted me to show, to demonstrate, that the x86 chipset was outperforming the RISC, the old RISC processing chipset. And, I mean, that was a sales point for them. Now, I don't know if they were actually asking me to lie or not, but I wasn't going to do that. I constructed the tests and took all the notes and, you know, took note of all the performance and all the variables and all these other things. It took months, and in the end, it was factual that the RISC processors, which at that time were like 4 or 5 years old compared to the x86 chips that they were competing against, the RISC ones just kept either performing as good as or a little bit better than. It was never a remarkable difference, but then again, there was a 4 or 5 year delta between the two, so, but it kept outperforming or performing as well as the modern x86 chips. So, I mean, from then on, I mean, even before that, I liked RISC processors. I mean, my first experience with Unix and Linux was the PowerPC brand, right? It was not x86. So I've always had an affinity for Power chips or PowerPC chips. And after that job, I really sort of came to understand that RISC processing was verifiably something to kind of keep in mind. I mean, it had something going for it. Add to that the standard, I guess, argument for RISC processing, and that is that a market or an ecosystem or whatever you want to call it with just one type of thing is not good, right? Diversity is generally considered to be a good thing. It encourages innovation, it encourages exploring new avenues to do things, etc. It's not putting all of the eggs in one basket. It's just kind of good, you know? I mean, I'm not saying we need like 85 different chips out there, but certainly having RISC versus x86, it's probably not a bad idea. So IBM talking about the power architecture and Linux on the power architecture, and I guess recently, like this week, I guess, IBM announced at some trade show somewhere that they were going to invest like $1 billion, I think literally $1 billion, into Linux on the power architecture was kind of big news. So seeing them talk about that at this conference was very, very interesting. And it was doubly interesting that when the guy brought up those obligatory kind of like salesmanship slides where they do the little charts and the graphs and things like that. His numbers were, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I mean, what I saw in numbers on these slides were basically exactly what I saw in the numbers of my render tests. So when people started raising their hands and asking, you know, well, what about these benchmark tests? And are these, you know, are these realistic? And all these questions, I just wanted to stand up and say, yes, he's right. I can verify these numbers. This is exactly the stuff that I saw in my render tests. You know, I wanted to do that. I didn't, because IBM wasn't paying me to sit there and sell their stuff. But it was a very interesting talk. And RISC is an interesting topic. And of course, ARM is a RISC processor. So for whatever that's worth. So that was a great talk. I saw a talk on what else? Well, one notable talk, I guess, was Door-to-Door Geeks talk about podcasting. Now, I was really interested, I'm always interested, because I'm a podcaster, I'm always interested in learning how other Linux podcasters do their, you know, ply their trade. Like, what do they do to make their voices appear on your computer? So I attended his talk partly out of genuine curiosity and partly just to be supportive of Door to Door Geek, because he's a great guy. I've known him for a little while now, and he's got a great set of podcasts. And he's just when I say he's a great guy, I mean he's a great guy. Meeting him, talking to him, knowing his motivations of just like educating people and helping them get involved and understand Linux. I mean, it's really, really, you know, you get that feeling that it's authentic. He has no ulterior motive. Very cool guy, and I figured, okay, I'll go to this one talk, because, I mean, he had, like, 5 talks at the conference this year, because I guess he'd gotten scheduled for, like, a Meet the Geek question and answer session that lasted something like, I think it was 3 hours. So I figured that this podcasting talk was probably the one that was really interesting to me, so I went to it, and it was really interesting. This guy's production method is, let me say, way more complex and a lot more correct than mine. Mine, let me do my podcasting talk for you. Find something that records audio, turn it on, start talking. That's kind of my workflow. His involves getting a hardware microphone, like a nice microphone, getting like a hardware compressor, which is, I mean, it's a great idea. Believe me, it's a fantastic idea. I think it was a compressor. Maybe it was a gate. I don't know, a limiter or a gate or something. But it was something along those lines, right, of modifying and kind of controlling the signal. Getting possibly a mixer, hardware mixer. Think maybe an audio interface, like an, you know, audio to USB kind of interface. A lot of stuff like that. It's great. I mean, it's great, and he had a lot of very good recommendations on the exact brand and models that someone could get, so that it was coming in well under $300, which I think is very, very reasonable. He also has this method of, I mean, it's kind of brilliant, frankly. I mean, he has this custom spun distribution that he and I guess a friend of his show sort of developed, and I forget what it is. It's a distribution with Qtractor and jack pre-configured, and everything's like set. It's set in stone. It's this virtualized environment, or not virtualized. Well, it is. I mean, he runs it in a virtual machine, so it's a virtualized environment of this custom distribution that is basically pre-configured. It's completely pre-configured. This interested me for a few reasons. Number one, because he was really talking about how he hates Jack, which I sympathize with him, but I don't know that I agree with him, and I'll talk about that later in this show, in this very episode. And he was talking about how he came up with this workaround, basically, of having to deal with Jack at all. And I thought, what could this possibly be? Well, it's a pre-configured distribution. And this suddenly kind of like made this light bulb go off, and I realized that Linux does not have to be traditional. There's no reason for it to be to constrain itself to traditional understandings of anything, right? So if you say, well, on blah 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 platform, I would never have to do that in order to do such and such. Yeah, but who cares, right? Linux has the ability because it is so finely tuned to distribute platforms that you can literally custom spin up a distribution for every task you ever do and just fire the thing up in a virtual machine and run that task on that distribution. In other words, every application, I mean, that would be extreme, but let's just say every application could be its own virtual machine of a highly tuned and specific and specialized distribution. And I don't care, I honestly do not care if other platforms or other operating systems, I should say, do that or even understand how that is possible or understand why that would be something you would ever want to do. If it works, then that's fantastic. And so the idea of a distribution becoming a platform for a set of applications, I thought was on some level brilliant. And I know it's not completely unique to Door to Door Geek, but sitting there watching him do that and realizing that this is what he does to do a podcast, and it's working for him really, really well. And he said that it takes him sometimes 10 minutes to edit a podcast, essentially, because he fires up his custom distro, throws the audio into a pre-configured Qtractor project. It's already got the intro music. It's already got the outro music. All he does is drop in the audio, and it's done. I just thought, wow, this guy is kind of, I mean, it's working. It's kind of brilliant. So I was really impressed by the idea that I need to break out of my, of the idea of, well, that just shouldn't be done or it shouldn't be necessary. But I don't know that it is necessary. Like, I mean, I do a lot of multimedia production on Slackware, and I don't have custom distributions for everything that I do, and I don't feel like I need them. But at the same time, I don't feel anymore, at least, that would be such a crazy idea either. Like, that could work. If I had, for instance, a non-DAW setup with 20 different inputs and outputs in Jack, a synthesizer, and a non-mixer, and CAF effects, and Guitarix effects, and I have it all set up exactly how I want to, if there is no established method of making all that come back up exactly as I left it every single time, then why not just roll it into a distribution? And distribute it that way. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, believe me, I'm not saying that that's the only way to do it. I would be just as happy if I could come up with, or if someone would come up with, you know, some kind of way to tie all of these components together in some way, which I do think would be helpful. And me and Scott Lavender from Ubuntu Studio have been talking about that in terms of recipes and kind of using KDE activities to say, hey, when I launch you, I want you to bring everything back up with all the inputs and outputs plugged into each other and all of my patches loaded. You know, I want to just pick up and resume my production. But if the way around all of that is just to roll it into a custom distribution, then go for it. I think it's a brilliant idea. And frankly, I'm belaboring the point now, but frankly, like when I download an application, or I don't download, but when I'm looking at a disk set of applications for a proprietary operating system, and it's like on 5 different disks, or even one, let's say it's on one disk, it's 8 GB, 9 GB DVD, or whatever they are up to now, and that's compressed, so you install it and it takes 30 minutes, because it has to decompress, or uncompress, you know, 9 GB into the 27 GB that it's going to take on your disk. But seriously, I mean, when I'm looking at these disks, and I'm seeing applications, a single application that is as large as one Slack's Linux download, or one Puppy Linux download, if Puppy's still around, right? It's DSL that's not around. Anyway, point is, you've got Linux distributions that are smaller than some of the proprietary software out there, and that's just the application. I'm not even talking about the operating system that it runs on. So if you have a distribution that's literally smaller than the application, and then you throw in some packages, and maybe now it's up to 0.5 GB, or even a full gig, you're still quite possibly, you know, you're still using less space than one of these proprietary operating systems. So what I'm saying is that it's really cool that Linux has redefined, in my mind, the idea of what an application is, what a platform is, you know, what the concept of a distribution is. I mean, with virtualization and distributions that can be custom created for any task that you want, I just think that that's really, really powerful stuff, and quite possibly we shouldn't take it for granted. And I feel like I have taken it for granted, and it's because it's not a traditional method of doing something, I have kind of ignored it. Anyway, back to Door-to-Door Geek's talk. It was funny, during the question and answer session, he was saying that Audacity could not export audio as a mono track, and I thought, well, that's not correct, because I export a mono Audacity project every 2 weeks when I'm doing a GNU World Order, so I chimed up and said, yes, it can. And he said, no, it can't. I'll show you the web pages that verify it. And so I kind of shut up, because I didn't want to, like, have a podcaster argument during his talk. And it turned out later that he was right, because he was speaking about MP3. So apparently Audacity cannot export mono MP3s. They're joint stereo MP3s via LAME, but not mono. And I was also right, because I was speaking, of course, about, like, WAVE and FLAC and things like that, which can do mono. Actually, specifically, I was talking about WAVE, because for my Speaks conversion, I need a WAVE file for Speaks Inc. to convert it to Speaks. So that's what I was talking about. And OGG, for that matter. I mean, I do mono OGG files all the time. I mean, I guess they're mono. I guess they could be joint stereo, and I just didn't notice. But I think the file sizes confirm that they're mono. But anyway, we were both correct, and hopefully a little bit of controversy there during the question and answer session made people feel like they were, you know, in a very exciting talk. But the talk was really good either way and very interesting stuff. So I gave a talk myself on FlowBlade. That was really fun. I felt very good about the talk. A lot of people asked me questions about it later on. Lots of people did. Very, very interesting use cases, and people were really interested in it. FlowBlade is an interesting video project. Roji, who you might remember from last season, told me about it. I'd never really heard about it, and once I started trying it, I really just kind of fell in love with it. So it isn't a Final Cut Pro Adobe Premiere style editing application. It's more structured than that. It's a little bit, if you think about it, it's a little bit more like Avid in philosophy. If that means nothing to you, don't worry about it. But it's very, very good. It's simple, it's fast, it's efficient. It's GPL version 3. It is Python, PyGTK on top of MLT and FFmpeg. So it's using a lot of the same technologies that Kdenlive uses, but it implements it in a different way, and it uses a different GUI toolset. So check that out sometime if you want to. It's a very good application. And there is an article in, I think it was last month's Linux Format magazine on FlowBlade. So you can buy that and read it if you want. And I think if you can't buy it anymore in your bookstore, you can order back issues online. I just don't know. I think it's issue 175. The closing talk for the Ohio Linux conference was by Kirk McCusick, I think is his name. Hopefully I'm getting that right. And he was the original project manager for FreeBSD or something like that. That was an interesting talk. It was a little bit more, well, at the beginning of his talk, he stated quite clearly that it was going to be a, quote, political talk. And he delivered. It was a bit of a political talk, meaning that the idea of sort of the licensing wars was a very prominent subject in the talk. It was something that he definitely did not shy away from discussing. And, you know, I mean, he really did not seem to be a fan at all of the GNU public license, the GNU general public license. Just didn't seem to find it very worthwhile. And he said something that I found a little bit interesting, which was that he found that with BSD, companies that were not legally required to contribute code back to BSD, as the BSD license does not legally require anyone to do that, still ended up contributing code back to BSD, mostly because they didn't want to have to deal with maintaining the code, the patches that they created themselves. I found this interesting and fairly surprising, and I wonder how broad that really is. I mean, I wonder if he was speaking specifically of the kernel, or whether he was talking about other stuff as well. And either way, I find that while some companies may do that, I would imagine that a lot of companies also withhold a lot of code as well. Because if they didn't, then there wouldn't be this debate over this term, quote, intellectual property, unquote. That simply wouldn't be something that it would exist, because companies are giving away their code after all, and it wouldn't be a big deal. So I don't know that, and if companies were going to do that, then I don't know why they would be opposed to the GPL at all, you know? I mean, if otherwise they wouldn't care whether something was GPL or BSD license, because if you're saying that the same result, that both licenses end up with the same result, I find that a little bit difficult to understand why any company then would be sure to use the BSD code instead of the GPL code. It just doesn't seem to make that much sense. So I don't know. I feel like in a world where people are using each other's codes, and I mean people are using each other's code, then I think that the BSD license could probably be a great thing. In fact, I would almost imagine that maybe it would be the preferable license, because it's just us people, you know? It's people that we meet on the streets every day, and we can go up to one another and shake each other's hands and kind of talk about the code and talk about what we're doing with it and all of these different things. And we could say, oh, gosh, that does sound kind of cool. You mind if I borrow some lines out of your code? And they would say, yeah, go for it. Or they would say, well, actually, no, you can't, because, you know, it's very specific to my thing, or I just don't feel like giving that to you, or whatever. And it would be this kind of personal interaction. So, you know, in the ideal world, where that's how things work, I feel like that would be a very pragmatic and practical way of dealing with licensing. What I feel about the GPL is that it's not really for people as much as it is for mega corporations. And if you're under the delusion that a mega corporation has any sense of moral duty or ethics, then you're under a delusion. There is no such thing in a company that considers nothing but their bottom dollar as important. So they're not going to give away code. They're not going to give back out of a sense of obligation. That's just not what companies, they don't do that. If a company gives anything back, it's because they feel that it's to their advantage, whether it's marketing or it's going to save them money on maintaining some kind of code or something like that. I mean, it just doesn't matter. There's no sense, you know, I mean, there's just, it's not going to happen. And even in a world where maybe the mega corporations aren't around, too many people, like if I don't think that it scales, you know, I don't think that the BSD license scales well. I think that it works in small groups where you have obligations and senses of morality and kind of interpersonal reactions where you can interactions where you can discuss how you feel a little bit slighted that they're not giving you their code when they based all of their work on your code. So wouldn't it be nice if they would give some of that code back? And okay, well, yeah, you're right here. Buy me a cup of coffee. I'll give you back the code. We'll call it even. That works fine. But in a world where there's just a bunch of people and then on top of that, a bunch of mindless, conscienceless corporations taking advantage of everything that they possibly can, including, like, I mean, everything. I mean, we're talking about people, we're talking about time, we're talking about the ecology, we're talking about just everything that a corporation can take advantage of, they pretty much do. I mean, that's almost self-evident, and it's all to make a dollar, and if you don't tell them, you know, if you don't speak in their language, which unfortunately is only the language of legal action, then they're just not going to do anything for you. Unless, like I say, it's to their advantage, like a marketing thing or oh, we don't have to maintain this code anymore. So yes, they might be giving some code back to BSD for their convenience, but they're certainly not doing it in other places, and they're certainly not doing it ever out of the sense of moral obligation. So I think that the GPL is more for that. I honestly don't think that the GPL is for individuals. I mean, if you think about it, back when free software, and this is because I read this book about Stallman, back when there was like a one building of people hacking in the MIT lab, there was no GPL, there was no BSD license, there was no license. It was a common understanding that we all get to look at each other's code. It wasn't a big deal. But once it started to scale out of that building and into businesses and people started business ventures and stuff like that, suddenly you had to start imposing licenses. So I think that's what the GPL license is really for. It's just for the inconvenience of having entities out there that have no sense of morality or ethics. And the BSD license, I think, I mean, again, a license at all, I think, is for the inconvenience of things being widespread, being more than just a group of friends having a mutual understanding. You know, and it's formalizing this stuff, and it's a pity that we need it to be formalized in this way, but I think that the BSD license does not formalize it in such a way that is advantageous to people. And anytime the corporation wins, I think that people are in danger of being essentially abused and taken advantage of, and I feel like that's kind of what the BSD license enables. You know, people can now be taken advantage of by the corporations, and I don't really think that they need a license for that. They seem to do that well enough on their own, whereas the GPL kind of fights for the opposite. That's how I feel about those two licenses, I guess. It's weird that the licensing issue is such an issue. It's a pity. I prefer to really concentrate on the generic Unix, and that's what's really interesting. And I like trying Linux and BSD and Solaris. I like these things, but the licensing issue is an issue. It's a thing. So I guess we have to think about it sometimes. But speaking of Unix, let's talk a little bit about Open Indiana. And by speaking of Open Indiana, of course, I mean let's have coffee first. So go get yourself a cup of coffee. I know this episode is running long, but have a cup of coffee. We'll come back, talk about Open Indiana, and then about Linux audio. because this episode is running a little bit on the long side, I'm not gonna dwell too much on Open Indiana, and that's also in part because I haven't really done a whole lot with it, but I did revisit the project recently. So in case you have not been up on your Solaris saga lately, this is how it went. Solaris existed. I suspect when Oracle was about to buy Sun, although I'm not really sure. I don't remember there being public talk about Oracle buying Sun at this time. All I remember is that Sun kept sort of appearing on, or, you know, representatives from Sun Microsystems kept appearing on podcasts, Linux podcasts, talking about how they were suddenly really, really excited about being much more open, much more open sourcey and friendly, and really wanted to build up a community and all this other stuff. And they were doing this for Java, and they were doing this for Solaris, and it was really kind of unusual, I felt. It was kind of surprising. But they were doing this, and there was this new project called Open Solaris, being head by Ian Murdoch formerly of the Debian project. So there was this Open Solaris, and that was really cool and exciting. And then Sun, of course, disappeared. They got bought up by Oracle. So now it's Oracle owns Solaris. And Oracle, I don't really remember, and I don't know the politics, I guess, of it, but Oracle, for all intents and purposes, killed off Open Solaris. I don't know if Oracle literally did that or if the Open Solaris project was just driven by Sun Microsystems, and when they went away, it was not continued. Whatever happened, Open Solaris essentially died that day. So, out of the ashes of Open Solaris, there arose the Illumos project, and I don't think initially anyone was really sure what the Illumos project was going to be, or what it was aiming to be, or anything. It was simply the new URL for Open Solaris. You know, it was, if you were interested in Open Solaris, now you went to Illumos instead of Open Solaris. So Illumos at this point, and I don't know if this is settled yet either, but at this point, right now, Illumos is the project for the kernel and, I guess, parts of the user land of the open version of Solaris. In other words, you could think of Illumos more or less as the kernel and the user land. I was going to say you could think of it as sort of the GNU of GNU Linux, but that doesn't quite fit because it's actually also the kernel, so it would be the Linux and the GNU of the GNU Linux, which really doesn't tell you anything or make sense. So, Illumos right now, for all intents and purposes, is a kernel. It's the upkeep of the Sun OS kernel. Or the Sun kernel, whatever they call it, I forget. And it is a project dedicated to taking things that are licensed by Sun Microsystems in a fairly restrictive way, which I guess would be the CUDL license, CDDL, whatever, versus taking all of those things and replacing them with more available licensed counterparts. So in simpler terms, they're taking all the Sun parts out of the user land, all those utilities, and replacing them with BSD, the BSD equivalents, and some GNU equivalents where, I guess we could say from their perspective, were unavoidable. Personally, I would be just fine with an Illumos kernel and a bunch of GNU utilities. I don't really see why that would be a bad thing at all. But that's up to them. It's Illumos project. So the Illumos project is that. So you don't really go to Illumos to download the latest Illumos distribution, for instance, any more than you would go to kernel.org to download the latest Linux distribution, although you might, since they do actually mirror a bunch of Linux distributions. But anyway, the current projects kind of hovering around Illumos would be, I think, Smart OS, which I, if I'm remembering correctly, is put out by Joyent. Which, of course, Joyent is the company that does Nexenta, N-E-X-E-N-T-A, which kind of was popular for a little while, maybe it still is, sort of as being, I think it's a Linux kernel with Solaris Userland or something bizarre like that. I don't know. It's a big mashup of a bunch of different projects, which, if I recall correctly, and I could be wrong, was, the big selling point of it was ZFS on a free platform. I could be getting all that stuff confused because I'm not up on all that stuff. I'm not so much, I don't really have a use for ZFS myself, so I find it a little bit obscure, but, so yeah, there's SmartOS, there's one called Illumion, which I installed on an old server that I had lying around and have been playing around with a little bit here and there. And there's Open Indiana, and there's a couple of others that they weren't downloaded by me, so I don't really remember all of them. But those were some of the big ones, and you can go to the Wikipedia page on Illumos and you will find a lot of links at the bottom to some current and some dead projects sort of that kind of hovered around Illumos and sought to make something distributable and actually usable from Illumos. So Open Indiana is the, I guess I will say, most Solaris-like of the offerings so far, although a diehard Solaris admin might argue with me, and probably rightfully so. So what I'm really saying, and it's kind of obvious, but I'm really saying it's the open Solaris-like. It's the most open Solaris-like of the offerings. So I'll backtrack a little bit. Illumion, for instance, is the Illumos kernel, and essentially Debian on top. It's kind of Debian on Illumos is what you could think of it as. So if you're familiar with Debian, you may want to check that out. It literally uses the apt-get package manager, so it's very much like Debian. Once you kind of get it installed, it's a lot like it'll feel like Debian. I'm running that on a test server. I haven't done a whole lot with it yet, because I really, when I had installed it, I didn't really realize, in spite of the name being fairly obvious, I didn't realize it was Debian on Illumos. I just kind of thought it was the Illumos project downloadable and distributable. I was really looking for an open Solaris replacement, because that's, after playing around with Solaris at an old job, the open Solaris one was the one that I tried at home, and that's kind of what I got used to. So Open Indiana is Open Solaris. Like if you've ever used Open Solaris, when you use Open Indiana, everything is exactly the same. The installer is, as I recall, pretty much the same. The GNOME 2 desktop is the same. The GNOME 2 theme that they use, I mean, the theme on GNOME 2 that they use is exactly the same. It's really pretty much the same. Now, I did not. The first install of Open Indiana, it's still a release candidate, I think. It's not like, they don't proclaim that it's stable or anything, but the first install that I did, I did on a test box with, I think, three other distributions on the hard drive, and so I was going to just try to take over one of the partitions of this multi-boot system, and that did not work. Open Indiana did not want to play nice with those other partitions, and in fact screwed it all up. I probably could have gone in and redone grub and all that other stuff. I didn't bother. I didn't have time. I just installed it. It's a test box. Who cares? I installed Open Indiana again over the entire drive. Not a problem. It has a really minor and weird, I call it a bug, desktop thing. You install it and the desktop background is bright, blinding green. It's just like this garish, horrible green. I mean, like, green, bright green. It hurts to look at it, but it's easy. You just click and change the wallpaper to what presumably was supposed to be the default wallpaper. It's a nice, deep, sort of blue, normal-looking wallpaper, so much, much easier on the eyes. And from there, it's really the same as running OpenSolaris. It has a package installer, a package manager called PKG, I think, just PKG. And it installs packages pretty much as OpenSolaris used to. I have not yet gotten around to trying OpenCSW with it, at all, which, of course, OpenCSW is the open, I forget what the CSW stands for, it's been a while, but it's the package, it's kind of like the Fusion, RPM Fusion, or the Debian Multimedia, or the Ubuntu, Multiverse, or whatever they call that one. You know, it's the extras, it's the extra repository for Solaris. I mean, there was the other one, Blastwave, I haven't checked in with them in a very long time. And OpenCSW just kind of, I don't know, I'm more familiar with it now than Blastwave, so that's probably what I'll try first. So if you're looking to play around with a Solaris-like operating system, Open Indiana will get you there. It's a nice little desktop, it's a nice little system to play around with. As I've said in the past, when I first tried OpenSolaris, it's kind of fun in a way if you're just looking to try out different flavors of Unix, then throwing in Open Indiana will remind you how different Unixes can be, Unices can be. There are commands that are familiar, there are commands that are different, there are commands that act very different. It is very interesting. To that end, actually, I'm also on my super domain fortress account, SDF, the free shell thing, been doing some minor shell scripting on there lately, and I was again reminded at how different sometimes, you know, things like the date or the WC command can be from system to system, and yeah, it'll screw up your shell scripts. And even said, heck, I had to actually, for the first time in my life, I actually had to define in a shell script to use gsed rather than just sed. So, it's interesting. It's an interesting study, and it's just kind of, I don't know, more tools to add to your tool belt, possibly, if you play around with it. So Open Indiana is worthy of trying out if you're interested in trying other flavors of Unix just for fun. That is all. I will report more as I learn more, I'm sure. I'm aware that talking about Linux audio and seeking to explain it from bottom to top as sort of an afterthought at minute 57 of a traditionally, I don't know, hour-long Augcast is a little bit crazy. But I did want to talk about Linux audio in this episode because I did talk about the door-to-door geek talk that he gave at Ohio Linux, and it dealt with audio, and it had me thinking about Linux audio and how it can be confusing, and how it doesn't always have to be as confusing as you think it is, and how sometimes it really is as confusing as you think it is, and the reasons why all of those things can be true at the same time. The one of the difficulties of talking about Linux audio are the two different user, or I guess use cases, that are very, very typical among Linux audio users. One is the typical desktop user. The other is the multimedia producer. I feel like the typical desktop user probably, I think that they've got their Linux audio all worked out. I think if you're a typical Linux desktop user and you're not doing any fancy kind of multimedia production, and by fancy I mean stringing lots of different applications together to get sound from one into the other, to record and to do effects. If you're not doing that sort of thing, I think that you probably have Linux audio down. All you have to worry about is Pulse. And Pulse at this point, from what I've seen, is pretty dang good. I remember that when it first got started, it was pretty disruptive, especially to the multimedia producers. But right now, I mean, certainly whenever I'm on a Fedora box, I'm usually just typing into Emacs. I'm not usually doing anything really fancy. But, you know, I might be listening to some music in the background in VLC, and I might have a video online of someone describing Geeks, the GNU packaging system, which is just voice, you know, in Firefox playing, and those two coexist perfectly fine. Non-intrusive music in one application, technical talk in another, they both play at the same time. I didn't have to do any kind of setup to make that happen. Pulse's job is finished, I think. It works. So, great. So, if you're on a system where you don't have Pulse and you're doing multimedia work, or even a system with Pulse and you're doing multimedia work, you kind of have to be, you have to be Pulse for yourself for a moment, at least so that you can understand what exactly your system sees, or the Linux system sees when you're saying, "Hi, Linux, describe my sound system to me." So Pulse, from what I can tell, basically looks at some of the really low-level ALSA output and simplifies it dramatically for you. And that's the nice thing about Pulse. And I'm thinking very, very specifically of the GNOME sound setup screen in the settings, in system settings in GNOME 3. If you look at that, it's beautiful. It's got like three tabs, I think, output, input, and maybe alert or something like that. And you click on one tab and it shows you all the potential outputs that your system has available to it. And wouldn't you know, typically, it's got one output. The computer speakers, maybe two, the headphone, I don't remember. But, you know, it's very, very obvious. You go over to the input. Wouldn't you know, there's one available input. The speaker on your webcam, or the microphone, rather, on your webcam. And then you go to alerts, and maybe there's, or I'm making that up, I think there's an alert section somewhere, and wouldn't you know, there's, again, one alert volume. It's the alert volume. Wherever it's outputting, it doesn't care. If it's an alert sound, it's going to be set to some volume, or some sound. So, Pulse dramatically simplifies this. But you can also do that for yourself, and I think a lot of the problem that multimedia producers on Linux have when complaining about Linux audio is that they are getting, first of all, way too much information from their computer. They're getting more information than they want, and they're getting different information from every application they look at. And that's not good, but that's what is happening, and don't worry, we can simplify this for ourselves. We just have to do a little bit of legwork up front. So if you, for instance, first of all, you have to make sure that that you have access to all the different ALSA utilities. In Slackware, it comes by default. I think on Debian and some other desktops, you have to specifically install it. So if you do an install of ALSA utils or ALSA tools or something like that, then you'll get things like ALSA Mixer, A Play, A Record, and A something else. So those are the tools that you probably want to have installed if you're looking to really understand your audio, what is underneath all of your Linux and what it sees as the audio system. So the easiest, most friendly way for me to see what my computer thinks it has available to it for audio is to type into a terminal. I have to be root for it, I think. I don't know, actually. I certainly have to be root to access the ALSA mixer. No, actually, for this, I don't have to be root. So, aplay-l, as in list. This will list via the aplay application, which is just a direct little simple ALSA player for sound. aplay-l, capital L, rather, lists all of the sound playable interfaces that ALSA sees on your computer. And the reason I like this is because it does it in a pretty nice human-readable way. So it gives you the sort of computer name for each device. It gives you the vendor name for each device. and then it gives you a human-readable, friendly description of what that device thinks it is, or what your computer thinks that device is. So in other words, if I do that on my system right now, the one that I'm recording on right now, Aplay-L, then I get default card equals PCH, HDA Intel PCH ALC270 analog. So that's the vendor name, or the, you know, that's what I'm looking at. And then it says default audio device. That doesn't tell me a whole lot. So I go down to the next one, sys default card equals PCH. Again, HDA Intel PCH ALC270 analog. So the same physical thing. And then the description of that is default audio device. Again, not very descriptive. Finally, next one down, front card equals PCH, dev equals 0, HDA Intel PCH ALC270 analog, front speakers. Well, that tells me something. So you have three different line items, or three bullet point items for really the same thing, except not exactly the same. So the default card is just telling me, and the sys default, those are telling me I have a physical sound card in my system. It is the Intel ALC270 analog card. I have no idea what any of that means, but that's what it is. That's the physical card. That's the one that shipped with my little laptop. Okay. So then it's telling me that on that card, so as long as I see that I'm on the default card on the HDA Intel ALC270, whatever the heck that is, as long as I see that referenced, then I have outputs, you know, within that card. And one of them is the front speakers. The next one down is the surround 4.0, and then there's a surround 4.1, and there's a surround 5.0, and a surround 5.1, and a surround 7.1. So supposedly, I'm pretty sure this isn't correct, but supposedly this card, maybe it is correct, is surround sound capable up to 7.1. So that would provide me a front, a center, a side, a rear, and subwoofer, or rather woofer speakers. And that would be 7.1 audio. I don't know how I would manage that. I don't know. But I mean, that's what the capabilities of that card are. But me, myself, I know that all I care about on a laptop is the speaker. And that is front, HDA Intel front speaker. So that's essentially, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 reports that I have received for essentially one output, or I should say one device, and that device is my computer sound card. Now, on the sound card, there is a front speaker, which I just kind of intuitively know because there's a computer speaker, right? It's a laptop. There are speakers on it. So that's the front speakers. That's what it's calling it. Those are the PC speakers. And there's a headphone jack. So if I have my earphones plugged into the built-in sound port of this laptop, then everything that is labeled this sound card, the Intel sound card, usually it would apply to the speaker on the out, you know, that outputs sound on my laptop. If I have a set of earphones plugged in, then it applies to those earphones, because it's obviously just going to toggle between those two devices. All right. So that's the output of Aplay-L, and it kind of shows you, I think, in human-readable terms, how overwhelmingly complex a single sound card can look, and how simple it can be in your mind if you can force yourself to ignore all of those and just tell yourself, okay, that sound card exists, it has two different outputs, either the PC speakers or a set of earphones. That's that. To view that in a test scenario, you can launch Alsa Mixer, which I have to be root for. I don't know if you do on your computer or not. But if I become root and I type in Alsa Mixer, all one word, then it launches the p- possibly if you've been here before, familiar in Curse's interface of your computer's controls. Now, unfortunately, dismally, this reports a completely different set of outputs than what I saw in Aplay-L. But again, it's deceptively complex. It's a lot simpler than you actually think. So in my ALSA mixer, and of course your results will differ, and I mean, heck, my results differ depending on what computer I'm in front of, because obviously computers have different sound cards and they're reporting back different things to the operating system. So we're just seeing a bunch of raw output. So what I've got in my ALSA mixer is one column, one channel labeled master. Master is actually an umbrella term, basically meaning whatever is the dominant output of at that point. So it might be my speaker, it might be my headphone, I don't know, it's an umbrella term. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell me that it's an umbrella term, it's just labeled master. I wish it would tell you that that's essentially an alias for system output, but it doesn't. So master is there. And then I have not one, not two, but three reports of headphones, which is, again, kind of over complex. There's the headphone, and then if I arrow over and look up at the label in ALSA Mixer, it tells me, okay, now the next column is actually the headphone mic, which doesn't even apply, not one bit, because this, I don't have a headphone with a microphone for my normal speaker. I have a USB headphone with a mic, but this actually doesn't apply. So I just turn that all the way down just so I can ignore it and forget that it even exists. I can mute that one. The next one over is a headphone mic boost, which again does not apply because I don't have a headphone mic. So the fact that ALSA Mixer reports these things, unfortunately, I don't even know where that comes from. It certainly isn't in Aplay. Maybe it's in Arecord, I don't know. But just, you have to kind of filter through this excess. The next one over for me is speaker. The speaker is actually the speaker. That's the front speaker that we saw in Aplay. And that's great. That's accurate. That is the most direct route to controlling the volume of my speaker possible. Now, it's being duplicated by the master channel, because again, the master channel is an umbrella term for whatever's playing the sound right now. Next to speaker, I have also PCM, which, as far as I can tell, I mean, I don't know if, you know, I don't know the lower levels of these things, but the PCM and the speaker seem to be exact duplicates of one another. I don't know that there's a difference between those two. Certainly if I lower one or lower the other, then the sound decreases in the output of my physical computer speaker. So for all intents and purposes, those two are the exact same. I wish there was a function in some interface in Linux Audio that I could just tell my computer, okay, from now on, don't report those two things as separate items. Report them as one thing and call them speaker for me, because that makes sense. But I do not know of a way to do that. That there's probably a way in some ALSA configuration file to make that happen. I don't know what that is. I've not explored that option a whole lot yet, so I don't know how to do that. All I know to do for my own brain is to tell it, okay, speaker and PCM are the same interface. There's a SPDIF option channel. I don't use HDMI audio. I don't use digital out, so that is meaningless to me. There's an auto mute. I don't know what that means. I disable it. And there, then in my, this is my playback category, there's an internal mic. I don't want to hear sound through my internal mic, ever. A microphone is an input device, not an output device. So I can mute that and ignore it. So essentially, if you've been keeping count, and hopefully you haven't, I've reduced a screen that is reported 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 items. I've reduced it down to essentially two things, which, if you'll recall, is exactly the number of things that we concluded my sound interface was capable of. A speaker and a headphone jack. And in fact, if I look at the things that I've left unmuted or unreduced, I have master, which, remember, is an umbrella term for everything outputting sound, and I've got headphone, speaker, and PCM. And if you'll recall, we've already concluded that speaker and PCM are the same thing. And I could conclude those things if I wasn't recording something right now. I could conclude that by simply playing some sound on some application, something loopable preferably, but not Audacity. I prefer to use something a lot more dedicated to sound output. So I just do an in-player and put on some very long track. I think there's a weird sort of space rock band called Fat Chance Lester, and one of their albums is like literally an hour long. So if you play that, it's called Napalm Lounge, available at osteopod.com/Lester. If you play that album, yeah, that was a reference to my own stuff. I slipped it right in there. You didn't even notice. So if you play that album in MPlayer or something, and then go through and adjust master, then you would hear the sound reduce. And then you could go over to speaker and reduce that, and you would hear the sound go down. And you turn it back up, go to PCM, sound goes down, goes back up. You could plug in your headphones, and again, you would find the output and input for headphone. And that would be that. Okay, so you would then want to go over to your capture listing in Also Mixer and kind of figure out what actually is an active interface there. Okay, so whether or not any of this is useful to you anywhere else is unfortunately a little bit of a toss up. If you go to any other application on Linux, they may very well report a completely different set of outputs for you. They may not, but they might, or they might just label them differently. So in my case, I use KMix for my mixing interface. It's not my favorite mixing interface in the world. Again, GNOME sound settings is really, really good. It reduces all that for you, but that's Pulse. So if you're doing a lot of multimedia production, you might not be using Pulse. And so you're not having things reduced into super simple, friendly terms like that. So if you go to KMix or whatever your mixer of your desktop is, what I typically do is go into settings, I go into configure channels, and I turn everything on. I throw everything in there that's available. I have everything showing, which ultimately I wouldn't leave on, but initially that's what I like to do. Just to kind of, you know, I'm kind of reverse engineering the audio system of a computer, so I want to see everything. And I go through and I test everything. And usually the names of these channels are fairly similar. I mean, I've got a master channel, so that's, sure enough, the master umbrella term. I've got a headphone channel, and sure enough, that does control the headphone. I've got a speaker and a PCM. Sure enough, those two do the same thing. And then I've got, like, an internal mic, again, for playback. I don't need that, so I turn that down. I have something called Capture, which isn't really a playback device, and it's significant, so we'll come back to it. I have something called IEC 958. Wow, never heard that one before. What that turns out to be, if I do a little bit of investigation by reading my Aplay-L output, I realize that IEC 958 is the vendor term for the HDMI output, which is another term essentially for SPDIF. So that's all fine and not really something that I'm using, so I could mute it or ignore it or whatever. I've got, again, a headphone mic, which, again, I'm not actually using, not this way at least. It's on a different interface. I've got an internal mic boost. I've got a headphone mic boost. And I've got this auto mute mode, which I still don't even know what that does. I've enabled it, disabled it. It doesn't seem to do anything. So, once again, I've kind of just accounted for basically everything. And then what I do is I move everything that I don't actually care about back out of my overview list. So yes, they're available to KMix. No, I don't need to see them on an everyday basis. When I click the full mixer interface. All I really need is my master channel, which is what I use as the controlling, you know, when I click my little K-mixer thing, what I see is master, because that's really what I care about. And then if I click for further details, then I'll see my headphone and my speaker as separate items, because sometimes you might want those as separate items. And then I see my internal mic, just in case I ever want to adjust that as an input device. And I have this capture option. So the capture option is, at least, again, on my computer, because the headphone jack stupidly does a dual job of being both a headphone input and a microphone input, meaning that you can have like a hybrid microphone or a headphone rather with a microphone in line and use it that way. I think that's really stupid. I don't know why anyone would combine an input and an output port. I guess for those people with the dual headphones that also have microphones on them, but I dislike that. But the capture will basically turn on or off an inline recording capability. It's dangerous because if I have that turned on, then I run into issues where it actually thinks my earphones are microphones, and it does really bizarre things. So hopefully your system does not have that feature. But again, you can't really blame that on Linux Audio as much as you can on the manufacturers of this stupid hardware. I mean, it's not really Linux Audio's fault necessarily, although I guess Linux Audio certainly could parse that a little bit better for us. Okay, so essentially, then, Linux Audio is an exercise in looking at output that is probably overly verbose and reducing it to real-world translations. The real pity is that you cannot, as far as I can tell, go in and customize all of these names on your own and actually make them do what you know, look like what you would recognize them to be. So if you've got, you know, I mean, especially if you've got three different headphones being reported or three different microphones being reported, and you know for a fact that you actually only have one microphone on your computer, then what are you going to do with the other three? So the best I can do so far is simply configure KMix to reflect a sane configuration and control my devices through KMix and not really worry too much about Ulsa Mixer now that I've seen what Ulsa Mixer reports, what it's calling things, what the actual controls are. I let KMix pretty much deal with it from there. Okay, so it's just really, so far, all we've done is we've looked at what is available in our system. And that's the, kind of the best thing to do. Like, if you're dealing with Linux Audio for multimedia, that's the first step that you want to do. If you've installed Linux onto a computer, stop, take a deep breath, take an hour or 45 minutes or whatever it'll take to sit down with your system and really look at what Ulsa sees, look at what it thinks it sees with Aplay-L, see what it allows you to control in the Ulsa Mixer, and then look and see how your GUI friendly everyday system that you're going to actually use to control this stuff, how it sees all of that stuff. And it will be deceptive. It can be deceptive, I should say. Because if you go into configuring your channels, you'll see all kinds of different outputs, like that PCM thing, which is valid, but it actually just duplicates speaker. So if you have both of them activated, it's going to confuse you when you go back there someday to lower your speaker volume, and you're looking at this, and you see a master and a speaker and a PCM volume, and you're thinking, why do I have three devices? All I want to do is turn the thing down. Well, what you really want probably is master or speaker or PCM, but probably not all three. So kind of paring it down and simplifying it for yourself is a very good method to doing this. Now, as for Jack, of course, looks at Ulsa as well, so it's going to look at the same devices, not necessarily give them the same name, and you get to kind of deal with all of those things again in Jack. So Jack can be kind of interesting because it's a patch based system, and it sees things a little bit almost in reverse from how we think of it, so that we have these things called readable clients or output ports and writable clients or input ports. And you really have to step away from the idea of, okay, a speaker is an output device and a microphone is an input device, because now you're no longer talking necessarily about physical devices at all. You could be talking about something completely different. So, for instance, I am going to launch, and I'm doing this while I'm recording this on the same computer. So it's not as restrictive as you may think. It's something that you can really play around with. So, all right. So I've got Jack open. I've got non-timeline, for instance. So as an output device, I have the timeline, because the timeline, the non-DAW timeline, is something that will output sound. Yes, if I start playing it, then it is an output device, and I would want to pipe those connections from non-timeline to my system sound, such as my playback_1 and playback_2. Now, as I've said, every application in Linux sound, unfortunately, calls everything something different. That's probably the most problematic of all this stuff. It's just the inconsistency of all the terminology. Again, I think Pulse is probably doing a lot to kind of simplify that as well, which is nice. So we've got this timeline, non-DAW timeline, and it can be an output device. So we're going to pipe it into the system's playback. And the system playback is a little bit like master, right? It's an umbrella term. It's whatever you're playing sound through. It could be your headphone port. It could be your computer speaker. It doesn't really care. It's abstracted. It is the thing that you hear sound from on your computer, the physical computer device. So if you connect those two, then if I were to play sound in non-DAW timeline, then I would hear it through the speaker. And conversely, timeline can also be an input device, essentially, because if I hit record and start playing a synthesizer that I have piped into non-timeline, then I am now recording. Yeah, I'm recording from that device to timeline. So non-DAW timeline is both simultaneously an output and an input device, which is kind of cool. I mean, it's also kind of normal, because pretty much any audio recording application is that. But seeing it in Jack and realizing that the same thing can be two different things is kind of interesting. So if you are recording from your capture device, your system capture, again, that's an umbrella term for whatever it is that you are inputting through, and usually on a computer it's going to be the internal mic, but it could be an old fashioned 1/8-inch microphone too, or 1/4-inch microphone converted down to an 1/8-inch. It just kind of depends, and in that case you would then have to go back to your KMix or to AlsaMixer and make sure that your webcam microphone is turned down or muted, not active, and that your 1/8-inch microphone in your sound card is then turned up or is active. And that's really kind of standard. I mean, that's not so unusual in any operating system. I mean, if you've got multiple devices and you're recording, you kind of have to tell the application and the operating system what the correct source is, because otherwise you'll potentially be getting sound from both. And believe me, I've done that before. I've been recording things and then realized that not only is the microphone on, but the webcam microphone was also on. So we're getting like this dual system sound of really, really clear, nice audio and sort of room tone by accident because the webcam microphone was on. So I haven't done that on Linux. I did it before I knew what Linux was on a different operating system. But, I mean, it's possible is what I'm saying. So you kind of have to define and kind of control what input goes where and when you're using one over the other. And that's why reverse engineering your Linux audio system is kind of important with AlsaMixer, so that you do know where to look when you need to switch between the two, and what they're actually called, and what actually are live, valid channels of audio, and what have just been duplicated or have been reported, I guess, because the sound card someday supported, you know, a headphone microphone boost, which I'll never use in my life. So it's just, you know, being familiar with it. And if you're familiar with what Alsa sees and what it reports, then when you go into something like Jack, it becomes a lot more clear to you, I think. Alsa is a MIDI driver, so when you're piping, or it can be, when you're piping USB MIDI events to synthesizers, then that would be done in your Alsa tab as well, where you can send all input from, you know, this LPK25 or whatever, send it to Zen Sub Add Effects or Zen Add Sub Effects, whatever, and then suddenly you're playing soft synths in real time on your little USB keyboard and feeling like Rick Wakeman. So yes, that's what's going on here. That's Linux audio sort of explained. And I know that's not really explained, but it is the process, I think, of really becoming familiar with this. I find in Linux multimedia, the thing that trips, that has tripped me up when things trip me up, is unfamiliarity with the system. And that, again, that's why I like Slackware. It's why I use Slackware on top of, or all this multimedia stuff on top of Slackware, because it really does encourage the user to get to know the system. Sometimes by hook or by crook, sometimes you just have to because you really want this one application and it doesn't exist yet, so you have to custom compile it, or maybe you want it a certain way and so you have to custom compile it. But at least you know, you really, really learn everything about your system. You know its capabilities, you know the different things that all the different systems kind of are aware of, and it becomes very, very, very handy. So, Linux audio, to sum up, it's overly verbose, and you have to cut through all the excess. You need to find what are valid audio channels for your setup. And I would recommend finding the valid audio channels for your typical setup. In my opinion, it's not that important to know exactly what the IE958C interface allows you to do if you're never going to use it, and I'm never going to use it. So I ignore that one. If I ever get a device that plugs into my HDMI port, then maybe I'll look into that. But for now, I use a total of 3 devices. A pair of headphones to listen to music, the computer speakers on a normal basis, and a USB headset to do podcasting. And that's it. And that's all I know about this laptop, sound system-wise. And that's all I need to know. And that way, when I sit down to record music, or when I sit down to do a podcast, or when I sit down to do whatever I'm doing, record sound from some other source, whatever, I know exactly how to do it, and there's no confusion. I know where to send signals. I know where to record from. I know where to record to. I know what applications talk to Jack and what applications do not, and so on. So it's not terribly confusing. It's actually pretty understandable, but you do have to take the time to really get to know it. And that's, I think, about as much as I can say about Linux audio without just kind of saying the same thing over and over again. Well, one thing that does probably deserve repeating, there's not a lot of consistency with Linux audio terminology, unfortunately. As I've already demonstrated, Aplay-L and AlsaMixer report really, really different things. And that's upsetting, because you, especially since both, as far as I know, come from ALSA. I mean, I don't think they're third-party applications. I think they're bundled with ALSA. I could be wrong. But I mean, they're, either way, they're all looking at the same information, right? They're looking at ALSA. So to report a completely different set of terminology to the user, and then having yet another set of terminology reported in KMixer, and then yet another, and I didn't even touch on this, in the system settings of KDE, where you go to Phonon, that a fourth set of information, and then a fifth set of information when you go to Jack, that is not good. That's not user-friendly. That's just not, that's not cool. But, you know, I mean, we can sit around and sort of bemoan our fate over the inconsistency, or we can just cut through it all, which is what I choose to do, and just reverse engineer it, find out what these the terminologies are really referring to, do it from bottom up, A Play to A Mixer to whatever your desktop mixer is, and go from there, and you'll understand it. And knowledge is power, and power is audio. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Lately.